Transformative change is difficult, but it can also be a powerful catalyst for growth and innovation. My name is Michael Carter, and I am the President and Managing Partner of Level 5, and you are listening to the Opportunity Unleashed podcast. Each episode, I get to speak with an inspiring business leader who has successfully championed transformative change within their organization, and or have had to navigate it within the market they play in. Regardless of the challenge, they have demonstrated incredible leadership throughout the journey. Today, I'm really excited to welcome Nicole McNeil to the podcast, President and Chief Administrative Officer of MPAC. And while you might recognize the name MPAC from your property assessment notice, they actually offer so much more value to the property owners, businesses, municipalities, and the provincial government. And I'm going to bet more than most people realize or think, which is why I'm excited to have you here. So welcome, Nicole, and thank you for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you, Michael. I'm very excited to be here.
Perfect. So let's start with that right at the top. You know, quickly, please explain the role of MPAC. And I know to a fault, many people probably think that you decide people's property taxes, and we know that's not the case. And so I'd love you to help people understand, truly understand what MPAC does and the value that you bring to the stakeholders I mentioned earlier.
Well, you're absolutely right, Michael. It's the first thing people think of. They think we're the property tax people. In a nutshell, MPAC is responsible for not only assessing, and when we say assessment, we mean valuing, but we also classify every single property in the province of Ontario. And there are 5.6 million properties in Ontario. Ontario is a big, vast province, lots of complexity there. So we have property inspectors and people all across the province. We have about 1,800 people. And we not only classify and value them as part of a reassessment, which does distribute taxes, I'll get there in a minute. We also look at what happens in the province every single year. So if you, for example, at your home decided to put a garage on your property, we're going to see that every year. And that's our job and responsibility to go and value that. So that is our core responsibility. And then what happens is we use all that information to deliver to municipalities, and then they distribute taxes based on that valuation. So that's our core business. But you're right when you say we're so much more than that. It's funny because MPAC is the second largest of its kind when we say assessment jurisdiction in the world.
I was going to ask you about that. Like you said, 5.6 million homes. I don't think people have an appreciation for that context. Can you maybe like compare it to a couple of other geographies so people understand just how mammoth of a role you play or job you have?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no one near us. So the only assessment jurisdiction that is larger is the UK. They have about 30 million properties, but they're not valuing them as regularly as we are. So when you look at other assessment jurisdictions that are smaller than MPAC, British Columbia is just under 2 million properties. When you go south of the border, they're done by county municipalities. So they're much, much, much smaller. So we are known in the industry as being one of the largest and one of the most complex and often sought after for advice, insights, whether it be our data asset. And I'll tell you, our data, a lot of people don't realize this, but we have a third of the size of Netflix of data running in the cloud. I know.
Oh my gosh, that is mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling. So it's a very valuable resource for us. We need it for our job, but it's also one of our commercial lines of business. So we sell a lot of that data commercially. And the benefit of that is it not only helps other commercial organizations that are looking to utilize that data, we take all of the profit from any of those commercial sales and we directly offset our costs. So it brings our entire budget down, which means the cost for our services to municipalities come down.
Which means it directly offsets even property taxes at the end of the day.
At the end of the day, it all trickles down to the consumer's pocket. Yeah. And then most recently, because we are so unique in our size and our complexity, we had to build our own software because you can't, there is no SAP for assessment jurisdictions. So we've been building and harvesting our own software for years. And for us, we needed to make sure that it was secure. We needed to make sure that it was fast, that it could process all the different models that we're running. And so about 5 years ago, we started getting questions from the international landscape saying, you know, would you sell this software? And about 2.5 years ago, we became a commercial software vendor. We've sold it to the City of Ireland. They're running Ireland as a country, are running our software. And we just most recently signed with City of Winnipeg.
Yeah, that was exciting news. Neat to see the second one under the fold for sure. And the other one, it's funny, talking to one of your team members, Scott, the other day, one of the things that blew my mind away when you compared jurisdictions, I think you mentioned that Greece, for example, has 4 property assessors for the whole country. Like when you think of, to your point, not only the cadence of property assessments, just the complexity that you deal with here in Ontario. Just
absolutely crazy.
Okay, you and I share a common philosophy around the people first strategy. And I remember when I was, one of my first tech companies, I was on a panel and somebody kind of threw this question at the panel saying, you know, CEOs are kind of cut from one of two cloths. They either put their people first or they put their customers first. And I've always believed that you put your people first. And I know you have always placed people at the center of your strategic priorities. So maybe help us understand, you know, why is that? And how has that translated into success that you've realized to date with MFAC?
It's a great question. And if you look at our strategy, the first pillar of our strategy is actually called putting people first. And we live it and we breathe it. And you're right, we do put our employees at the center of everything. And eventually our employees are the ones who are at the center of our customers. So if your employees are not happy and not being treated fairly and with respect and engaged and valued, then they're not going to value our customers either. So that is something that I've always operated with, as you know, prior to this, I was a CFO. It's always been my, it's been part of my DNA to put people first. People are complicated. And in order to bring your best self to work, you have to really understand people and you have to allow them to be their best self. And when you think about the amount of time that we invest in an organization, 40 hours a week, that's a lot of time. And not everyone can show up the same day because things happen. We only know this little sliver about people. So I would say in the last, in my tenure, including in the pandemic, which really moved a lot of things forward, is we focus a lot on mental health. We focus a lot on trying to reduce stigma in the organization. Vulnerability. The pandemic really brought out my vulnerable side as a leader. Yeah. And it's something that I wasn't expecting, but it's definitely something I continue to lead with to this day. People resonate more with it when you're a real human, when you're a real human and you can actually talk to them and be understanding. So absolutely, people first. It's so much so that one of the things we're thinking about is how does that actually become not so much a pillar, but this cross-cutting theme? Like, how are we making sure that we're putting people first in our organization when we're making decisions in the organization as we're, you know, depending whether it's an operational decision, a people decision, a customer decision. And then ultimately, as you say, that translates to our own clients, whether they be municipalities, commercial clients, stakeholders, the province, the industry stakeholders. Our people are the first line of contact. Yeah. And so if they're not feeling valued and engaged, then that's what happens.
Yeah, it was my answer to it was really quick. It's if you take care of your people, they'll take care of your customers. And it's not the other way around, right? It's not growth at any cost. It's not your customer needs at any cost, even though part of what I've admired about your journey, and you have been on quite a transformative journey since you took over, we've witnessed a shift in maybe perhaps being a little more product-led to what I think of very much as customer-led. And so maybe talk a little bit about how your focus on people has allowed you to be more, and you touched on it, but has allowed you to be a bit more customer-centric in your approach to the market and the organization as a whole.
It was historically, when you think of our organization, we're big and we're complex and we know that. And we're trying every year to simplify things, to make things easier. And really what it starts with is listening to your customer. Mm-hmm. And really understanding their needs. So taking it more than delivering our statutory product, which we deliver every year, taking that role, but really understanding the needs of municipalities, as an example, is one of our biggest clients. And if you look at their needs now, I mean, how often do you open the newspaper and all you hear about is housing targets, affordability, all of these things are really, really important to them. And then how can they make decisions? Well, they need data. and they need the data that we can provide. And so we're shifting our mindset and shifting how we work with clients to be less about, well, here's your product that that we're responsible to delivering to you, but what else? What is on your mind? How can we help you? How can we support you? We offer a lot more than just our statutory product. You know, one of the things we're quite proud of is our cyber stance and all of our certifications. Yeah. And, you know, when you have 444 municipalities in Ontario, some are very large and complex and have large departments and, you know, they're on their own. But there are some that are very, very small and they struggle being able to, you know, work through something. Yeah. And so if there's ways that we can help them, even better. But it you wouldn't know that if you didn't actually have the relationship with them. So it's really making sure that you have that relationship as opposed to, as you say, just dealing with the products that you deliver.
Yeah, and part of what the evolution has developed or produced is as you've said, it's allowed you to evolve your product offering and making sure that you're extending the value that you can bring. And I don't care whether you're a property owner like me or a big business or the government, that data becomes such a rich tool. And it started with listening to your customers more and understanding the needs more to see where you could add more value. And I think you've done a great job of evolving what you bring to market and to capitalize on the assets that you have, quite frankly, and not the least of which is people, as you mentioned. So I know AI is something that you think about a lot. And obviously without breaching any confidentiality of things that you're working on, how can an organization like MPAC leverage AI to be more customer-centric? Like, as you think of it in that context, because there's obviously operational efficiencies and things that you can play with, but curious to get your thoughts on that connection, AI as a tool or an enabler for being more customer-centric. Can you share some of that with us?
Sure. So we invest in people and we invest in technology. When you look at how our business operates, it's people, it's data, and it's technology. And so we're not new to looking at new methodologies. In fact, we were the first public sector organization, one of the first in the cloud with Amazon. And we were their largest public sector client at one point in time. We're no longer. We don't have that status anymore, but we were. But we were one of the first. And we did it because we had no choice. Our server costs were, you know, running through the roof. We couldn't keep up with the security requirements, but our business demanded that we were faster and stronger. Mm-hmm. And so we started experimenting with the cloud and it worked wonders for us. And then we built upon that. And that's really what we're doing with AI and machine learning now. So we use it now to this day. We have machine learning in our models. We're using artificial intelligence. We're using some chatbots just internally within our own IT support department. So there's lots of things that we're doing. But what we are going to be doing this year is really taking a holistic stance with AI because there's a lot out there on it. And there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of misconception. And so we're building it right into our strategy. We're going to build a center of excellence. We're going to build AI right up front because one of the challenges, even if you set aside the governance and you know some of the risks and the bias, it's people. It's scary. Like, what does this mean? I mean, you look at these deep fakes, you look at everything that's out there. And quite frankly, people look at it and say, well, is AI going to replace my job? And I heard this great quote the other day that said, AI won't replace humans, but humans with AI will replace humans without AI. And so what we're going to do internally is really look at how do we make sure that AI isn't being operated behind the curtain? How do we bring AI to the forefront and actually have staff-led initiatives? So employees would come forward with their own repetitive task, something that they're looking for help on, and almost pitch a business case to us.
Like a Dragon's Den format.
Like a Dragon's Den, absolutely. Yeah. So make it a little bit fun and make it less scary and make it helpful for people. And we have so many use cases within our organization. I think our challenge isn't going to be, what could we do? It's going to be like, unfortunately, we're going to have to say no to a lot of different use cases.
So can you, I mean, you've touched on the next question I was going to ask and you explain it quite eloquently, because I do think there's this big shiny object out there for a lot of companies called AI. And I think one of the biggest challenges is how do you humanize it, to use one of your words from earlier, right? Because it can be scary. People are going to think, am I out of a job? How's it going to impact my job? And it's so much more than the technology if you're going to be able to embed it within the organization. It's about culture. It's about the rest of your leadership team embracing it and so forth. But And I think you just gave some great examples of how you're doing that. Can you maybe give a couple of examples of specifically how that will help with your customer-centric approach? You know, how do you marry AI with customer-centric? You talk about chatbots, but maybe give a specific example around how that's helping you be more customer-centric, either listening and understanding customer needs more and or delivering on those needs.
It's a great question. I'm not sure whether we have the answer yet on that specifically, because one of the things that we can do with it, so there's two ways I think we can use AI. We can use AI to look at the repetitive tasks we have now to make us faster, make us stronger, and so on. And then there's what could it do for us that doesn't happen today? So to answer your customer question, are there ways that we can comb through some of our data to see some of the common questions that are coming through? So we have some technology and some tracking of that, but imagine if we were able to really isolate in on what some common areas were, or things that we're answering, you know, over and over again, that maybe there's a better way that we can serve customers. As you all know, like, how often do you pick up the phone? You really don't want to call anyway, right? You want the information at your fingertips. Sometimes you're looking at it late at night. You might want to use a chatbot. You might not. There's a lot of people who don't like the chatbots as well. But I think that will be an area that we can use AI to explore of how do we service our customers better. So if it's not us being at their office, meeting and talking to them, what requests are we getting in? What things are we processing over and over again that perhaps could make things more seamless to them, reduce their headaches, something like that?
And so to your point, you get the added benefit of it being a potential money saver, a cost saver, an efficiency gain for the organization. But at the heart of it is, how do you respond to my needs better, to your point? I mean, do I need to talk to a human in 60% of those 400,000 calls? Let's save the humans for when a human is really needed, right? And when you really want that personal touch, like you were explaining earlier, that's the important part where you want people spending their time.
Absolutely.
That's fantastic. Very cool. All right, I want to switch gears a little bit. And when you reflect on your time as the president of MPAC, guiding your organization through this evolution, and you touched on the pandemic and other kind of events outside of your control that have kind of forced you to evolve yourself, has your leadership style changed and evolved? And how, you know, as you look back, what have you learned about yourself and your leadership style through that evolution?
Thank you for that question. Maybe what hasn't changed has been my people focus. Always been a putting people first, but what has focused is I've just grown as a leader. I came into this role new. I was really only had a year under my belt before the pandemic started. And that was a tough time. It was a tough time for all of us personally, for me personally. It was a tough time trying to run an organization with so much uncertainty and all being remote. And I mentioned to you earlier that vulnerability is something that I've embraced. And I think that really came from the pandemic, was being vulnerable. And I was one of those, you know, women leaders that felt that you had to be strong. You had to almost fake it till you make it. You had to not show any type of vulnerability. And, you know, whether it was just forces that forced it to happen, it did. And it actually worked well. It was a bit of a relief for me to be able to be vulnerable and feel some support. And it humanized me to the rest of the organization that I'm a person, and yes, I'm a leader, and I'm a human, and I have vision, and yes, I carry the weight on my shoulders, but I have bad days. And there are things that, you know, I can't always bring my best self to work. And so once I got past that, I started to realize that's almost a bit of a superpower because you felt the support that you wouldn't normally feel. And I've tried to really keep that going since then. So I think that's been the biggest part of my evolution is, you know, trying to learn from the mistakes, trying to learn from obviously the things that go well, but growing and being that lifelong learner, regardless of whether it's leadership or if it's something technical. And, you know, you and I were joking at the beginning of this call that I said to you, oh, my co-pilot button is on my Teams. I can't wait to learn that. I'm going to learn it just like everybody else, right?
So
I don't have familiarity with these things. Just learning, embracing, trying to take feedback, but always evolving.
Kind of it forced you to realize that, you know, showing up as your authentic self was actually a strength, and that's, you know, better for you in your role as the leader and the impact of that on the organization. And, you know, kudos to you for that evolution, quite frankly, because I think it's a, I don't know that a lot of people realize that or feel it or show up that way. So I think it's a great win on your part for the organization and yourself, quite frankly.
Thank you.
Okay, last question, kind of along the same lines. So knowing what you know now, what advice would you give to your younger self? I'm not saying what would you do differently. That's not what this is about. But it's, you know, if you look back and go, man, if you had the benefit of hindsight, what would you tell yourself just entering this role? And more so from the perspective of being a leader, running the organization and having that vision of where you're trying to take it and the complexity of your company, but more from a personal side of the equation, what would you tell yourself?
You'll get through it. You'll get through it. You know, it's funny. I had this conversation the other day with a group of people, and you know, you do feel that as you get older, you get a little wiser, right? Yeah. And you get a bit more confident. You know, you've mm-hmm. you've been through things before. This too shall pass. But like, things are hard, and they're not always straightforward. It's not always a straight line. But you don't know that when you're younger. You don't know that when you take on new challenges. And you know, you've got to build a circle of trust around you. You know, with people, you know, you need to check in with yourself. But all of these things I've learned as I go, I think just like everyone else would. So when you say your younger self, I look at when I, you know, if I'm mentoring students that are younger or talking to students that are in high school, I always just say to them, just get through high school. Like, it gets better. Right. And then when I think of, you know, when I was younger in my career, you know, post-grad and stuff, like, it was really, really hard. But you get through it and you learn as you go. And unfortunately, you learn from the harder things than you do the easier things. So it's not always the successes that you learn the most from. Yeah. It's the ones where you've had failures and you've had setbacks. And so, you know, when I said, like, just keep going and keep trying, that's really the advice that I would give. And it does get easier as you get older, because you do get a little bit more confidence. You have seen a little bit more, and you try not to make the same mistakes. And if you've really got a great success, you really try to leverage that.
Yeah, very cool. And yeah, it's interesting. It's, what you said resonated to me about being younger, and I have two kids that are kind of coming out of university, a daughter that's already out of university, but it's this desire to have everything figured out so fast. And it's okay to not have it figured out, right? Even as a leader of an organization. And to your point, it's surrounding yourself with great people that can help you and that can play a role or a part of that journey, that together you can get through a lot of these things so much more than thinking you have to figure it all out yourself. So, I mean, I think that's a really good point, quite frankly, from young leaders that are kind of emerging on the scene and having similar opportunities that you may have had younger in their career as well.
Absolutely. Well, it's funny, like one example that a colleague gave me just this week is we were talking about being on a plane and having crying babies on the plane. And she was saying, you know, she was saying her younger self, you know, would have been annoyed by having the crying babies on the plane and so on. But, you know, her older self, having been through that, you know, had so much empathy for, you know, for the parents. You learn it, right? And then, you know, you want to get up and you want to help the struggling parents and maybe I can take a turn and so on. And so she was using this in the context of herself, you know, feeling that she has, you know, matured, she's older, wiser, been there, learned these things. So I thought that was a really great, a great analogy.
Yeah, it's a neat characteristic too, right? I mean, you talk about vulnerability a lot. I think that's a critical kind of trait or skill set, if you will, of good leadership. And I think empathy is another kind of somewhat underrated aspect of leadership, that as you get older and it's a learned behavior in a lot of cases. I think it's part of your DNA, but the more experiences you have with having to deal with that, the better you are at leveraging it, quite frankly, as well. And I think that's a really important part of leadership as well.
Absolutely.
Nicole, I don't want to steal any more of your time. This has been great, and I do appreciate taking the time. And I always love your perspective on not just MPAC and the role you have, but it's always fun for me to speak to leaders that I look up to and I think have a voice that others should hear and listen to as well. And to the extent that there's some pearls of wisdom to take away from this, which I do think there are, and I'm just grateful that you were able to take the time, and thank you for sharing your thoughts with us.
Well, thank you, Michael. That was fun. So thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Opportunity Unleashed, a Level 5 podcast where I profile inspiring leaders who have successfully navigated transformative change in their careers and or businesses. Our goal is to share great stories and hopefully leave you with a few pearls of wisdom that you can learn from. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to check back soon for our next interview.